This is the Heartland Collegiate Compendium. The legal and regulatory environment of business. Lecture 7, delivered on June 23rd of 2008. The title of this lecture is Business Torts.
Tonight, Business Torts. I do want to make some cleanup of torts in general. For example, let me get a couple of matters right away off the table. I think I've mentioned this before, but I'm not absolutely sure, so let me consolidate it. In terms of defamation, slander is oral defamation. Libel is written defamation. Slander is oral defamation. Libel is written defamation. In general. Now, moving to commercial, just for a minute, just moving to a commercial application of the concept of defamation. If you are the victim in a commercial enterprise of false, clearly misleading statements by a competitor, then you have a claim of injurious falsehood. Injurious falsehood. These kinds of torts, legal departments at companies go through ads all the time to make sure that they are skating by any valid claims of injurious falsehoods against their competitors. However, there are times when you do get these, how should I put it, rumors start. And it's always curious, it makes you wonder, well, where did this rumor start? With a competitor? Maybe. McDonald's serves worm burgers. Well, I have people who swear to God that it's a fact. Yeah, I know it for a fact. I heard it from a good, credible source who works at McDonald's. Now, these rumors, some of them start on their own, but some of them have, unfortunately, a more commercial side to them. But establishing that a rumor started with a competitor is difficult. But nonetheless, you cannot make directly false statements, nor can you make statements that put your competitor in a bad light through misleading declarations. So you would certainly get by with saying, ours is better than the leading brand because the leading brands doesn't work very well. Well, if you name the leading brand, you're getting into more of a possibility of being sued for an injurious falsehood. So oftentimes, if they do trot out the leading brand, they do so with only the most careful of language. Maybe a test done by an independent company. But even there, you're treading on thin ice playing that. Now, interestingly, back in my time, you would see competitors in advertisements bringing out other companies' products, competitors' products. You don't see that nearly as much these days as you did in my time. And it's just because of the litigious atmosphere and the fact that courts have entertained injurious falsehood suits and gotten injunctions against companies that said bad things about other companies' products. Now, let's try this. We have a car tire manufacturer. Its product has been recalled after dozens and dozens of people were killed because the tires exploded. Now, you are a competitor and you want to get market share, gain market share. Will you be within I don't want to say your rights, but would you be safe in putting up an advertisement, unlike this tire, and name the tire brand? Our tires don't explode and kill people. You're shaking your head. Why not? Well, what if, interesting. Well, suppose it were common knowledge that what the tire was, kind of tire was that had the explosions that killed people. Do you remember what tire it was, by the way? Does anyone?
Firestone, the Explorer tires.
I'm not going to say anything one way or the other, since this will be podcast, but you notice that I'm being somewhat careful in even mentioning the tire's name myself. So that informs you that it's probably not such a good idea for a competitor, even though, remember what I said, truth is an absolute defense against defamation? Truth is an absolute defense against defamation, unless there is some kind of privilege involved, that some reason why you have that truth that you should be telling it to others. But in general, truth is an absolute defense against defamation. So certainly, if I just tell the truth about the fact that my competitor's tire was recalled after many people were killed, and after lawsuits had come in, and those lawsuits had been collected into a class action, and the class won at suit at common law, why would I still want to avoid? That's my intent. I want to put them in a bad light, yes. But why wouldn't I do it? The problem is, and it's just as simple as this, the tire company that had the problems would have a claim. They could sue me. Now, would they win? It's hard to tell, but that's bad PR for me, having them sue me, certainly, and it's just going to be a legal mess, they're suing me. And God knows there is a capriciousness in the law with respect to lawsuits. There is a chance that they might win. Well, this poor tire company has suffered enough. It had to settle. It got its tire sales have gone down, and now this mean competitor is picking on it. I don't think I would want to do that, go there. If I were the competitor, I would simply market my tires as safe, possibly saying never subject to a recall, all that kind of stuff, maybe. But I would want to avoid just the legal mess. Torts against property. I want to clean up something about a couple of issues in torts against property. What was the tort against property that I described last time, the biggie, the great big 800-pound gorilla? Conversion. Which is the civil version of good. And remember, conversion doesn't mean you take it away. Conversion could mean that you actually don't take it anywhere, but you damage it in such a way that there is measurable economic injury as a result of the damage. So in a sense, in a very real sense, if you hit another car in a parking lot, as happened to me out here, some disgusting abomination of God hit my car and left, that person has committed a tort of conversion on me. That my vehicle is now converted from what it was before. And the damage is measurable. I can certainly find out how much it would cost to repair that. So that is a conversion there. Every bit as much as if the person drove off with the vehicle. In both cases, the common ground of both cases is that there was economic injury that is measurable. But conversion is not the only tort against property. Certainly, trespass is a tort against property. If someone walks onto your land, that is certainly a tort if that person is not invited and is discouraged from. However, as I had already pointed out, you are not within your rights to kill or otherwise injure a person for trespass. It's a tort, for God's sake. It is not justification for killing a man or having a dog that would hurt a person, or putting up fences that would rip a person to shred with concertina wire hidden in the bushes. There is the issue of proportionality first, and also the issue that human life and limb exceed and are completely different from, in a fundamental way, your stuff. Yes, you can sue this person. Yes, if this person threatens you, you can hurt that person in defense, in self-defense. However, you can't set up someone to be hurt badly just because that person has gotten into your house. You can't set traps. That person will sue, and that person should sue. That's how a civil society works. Excuse me. But, of course, there are also exigencies involved, too. Someone is stealing your car. Your baby is in the back of the car. The situation there, with respect to what would be reasonable to do, is somewhat different from what would be the case with respect to someone who was stealing your car and there was nothing in there but your briefcase. It is contextual, the extent to which you have the right to defend property in light of a tort being committed. But trespass is definitely a tort against property. And trespass does not mean trespass just on land. You can have trespasses against other things as well. Notice that there is if you think about it, there's a somewhat of an intersection between the tort of trespass and the tort of conversion. You have a book that is lying on a table. Now, this book happens to have in it pictures that you took of a boyfriend. And these are obviously pictures that you would really wish no one else would see, especially that one with him wearing that lambskin suit with the scuba gear on the head. Someone opens it up. Is that a conversion? Well, someone opens it up and looks at it. Someone you don't want to. Someone who just walks up to that book and opens it up. Well, let's say it's in a restaurant, at Denny's. You're sitting there, and you're distracted. Someone comes over and just opens up the book and looks. Is that a conversion?
No, because there's no measure.
Good. Oh, excellent. Oh, God, yes. Absolutely. But is it a trespass? Possibly. It's a trespass. Now, granted, you were in public, and you had that in public property, but you do still have a reasonable expectation of security in your private personnel belongings in public. Now, you might have been foolish and left it on the table and gone to the bathroom, but your foolishness is certainly no defense for someone against a claim of trespass. Not in that regard. And that's one of those unfortunate things that in my earlier life, I remember times when I had wrongs, I was injured by people when I was in the bad parts of town, and the police would simply say, well, you weren't supposed to be on the street, you're stupid to be out here, and they would make me feel very degraded, and that would be the end of the matter. Police were quite willing to make people go away, victims go away back in my time that way. And that was completely false logic they were using. I still have the right to my privacy, regardless of whether I have been foolish or not. Regardless. Now, certainly I was foolish, but at the same time, to be walking at night, but at the same time, that's not sufficient grounds for thugs to come up and beat me up and try to take my stuff. Any more than these claims that are done in courts by attorneys for rapists. Well, she was dressed provocatively. She was asking for it. If she got what she deserved, because if she had not been dressed like a hoe, she would not have been sexually assaulted. That's bullshit. It's plain patently on its face bullshit. Unfortunately, it does win the day sometimes, unless judges shut that line of argument down real quick. And sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Let me go on to negligence. Negligence does not require intent. There is no intent in negligence. Unlike fraud and even a lot of crimes, no one meant to do anything wrong, but there was some kind of neglect that led to something happening. Now, the first test, and these are one after the other, to claim negligence, first the victim must establish that there was a duty of care. Once that is established, then the plaintiff must show that there was a breach of that duty. You have to show that the duty of care existed, then show that there was a breach of that duty. And then from there you go and you have to establish the causation. Now there are two avenues. One of the avenues is to establish causation directly. The defendant caused the tort. The test, and the book uses this term too, it's the but-for test. The but-for test. But for this defendant's negligence, this would not have happened. If the defendant had not been negligent, there is no question at all that this would not have happened. And then there is the proximate cause. There was a chain of events. Now this defendant was not directly responsible for the injury, but the defendant was crucial in a chain of events that happened. Now here I bring up, and I'll bring this up more explicitly in just a minute, a Latin term, res ipsa loquitur. Res ipsa loquitur. The thing speaks for itself. Now, I will bring this up more explicitly, considerably more explicitly, when I get to design defects. But I'm bringing it up here because in some suits at common law, the facts are extraordinarily complicated. The parties that were involved are many, or the situation was really complicated. In a case like that, a jury can be spun around into the ground by all of the complexities of the who did this, who did that, when did this happen, when did that happen. All of those things can really spin a jury into the ground, and it gets very confusing. This doctrine says, once we've heard all this, let's get it off to the side and let's look at what happened. Really. Someone got hurt. Let the thing speak for itself. This person is hurt. Dear God, stop it with all of this. He did this. Well, let's look at these diagrams, 25,000 pages of diagrams, and let's look over here at the other companies, and let's go back in history, maybe about 3 centuries to the original conceptualization of this product. Come on. There's a point where that has to be put off to the side and let's say, all right, I don't like to use this term, but it's almost like, let's get common sense in here. This person was hurt. Who did it? Who the hell did this? Let's knock it off with all of this other mumbo jumbo. That's in a nutshell, res ipsa loquitur, or as non-Latin speakers, res ipsa loquitur. Anyway, enough of that. Okay, now as far as this proximate cause goes, the first thing, if you're going to try for a proximate argument for proximate causation, you have, at a minimum, you have to show that it was an instrumentality under the control of the defendant that caused the incident. Instrumentality under control of defendant. That caused the trouble to start, I should say, in a sense. And the accident normally would not have happened. I think the book used the word ordinarily. This normally would not have happened in everyday circumstances, except for the defendant's instrumentality. And there is no evidence of any other cause. Now, this one is actually, you got to be a little careful here, because you might be able to point to other causes, but are they real? If someone has gotten sick with salmonella poisoning, well, you can get sick from salmonella. Did you eat eggs? Are you sure they were? Well, yeah, I did. You know, I eat them a couple times a week for breakfast. Are you sure they were cooked enough? Yeah, do you eat them sunny side up? Well, no, I eat them medium. you know, over medium. Well, were they ever running one more? Quit it. You see, you're trying to show that there is a possibility of another cause. There's evidence. Well, yeah, you have admitted that you eat eggs. But we still have to look at the chain of distribution for the tomatoes that have been linked to the salmonella outbreaks around the country. You can go all you want trying to show that there are other possible ways that people could have gotten salmonella. And the truth of the matter is that there are times when someone in, you've got 100 people sick, maybe a couple of them didn't get their salmonella from your tomatoes, even though they ate tomatoes that came from your distribution. They might have gotten sick from another source of salmonella. However, it's very unlikely that you're going to be able to show any reasonable belief in the jury that there was another cause other than the tomatoes that were your responsibility. So just kind of keep that in mind. You can try, but no evidence. When I say no evidence there, don't think that means you're going to reach for the unlikely, because it's probably not going to play very well. Let me break out the class. The injury. You have to show that there was an injury for negligence. Negligence, show duty of care, show that a breach of duty occurred, show there was causation, either direct or proximate, and then you have to show that there was an there's injury. And the injury does not have to be physical. And the book brings this up too, and I'm glad that the book, some law books are talking about this now, is that there are times when you can argue for psychological injuries. You can be subject. For example, what if you are a fast food restaurant chain and you have accidentally sold, wonderful picture on the internet. Supposedly not a hoax, but there is question of that. It looks real, and there's a lot of good story behind it, which makes it more credible, although that could be a fake. Fried chicken, a big box of fried chicken. There's the woman holding the fried chicken. A picture was taken by a local television station. She got the fried chicken, took it back to work with her coworkers. They were eating it. Reached in, and she pulls out, yes, it is a batter-dipped, deep-fried chicken head. Yum. Now, was she injured by this in any physical sense? Certainly not. It didn't peck her. It was dead. Quite dead, I can assure you. It looked dead anyway. Did she get sick from eating it? She didn't eat it. But was there still an injury? Possibly. There are some people who would really, really have emotional problems with that. And there are many stories over the years of people who have pulled things out. A lot of them are fake. Sure, there are fakes, but there are also very real, quite real stories of finding animal parts in food, finding all manner of other things. Okay, so keep that in mind. Injury does not have to be physical. Mental injury can be harder to measure unless, say, this person, I couldn't go to work for the next week after that, so I want to be made economically whole. Okay, so it's still possible to get damage awards for injuries that are not physical. By the way, while I'm thinking about it, there are two classes of damage awards. There are compensatory damages, and then there are exemplary or punitive damages. Two classes of damages. Compensatory damages are the damages awarded to make the person economically whole. Exemplary damages are punitive and made to deter that behavior from happening again, both by the defendant and by others who might contemplate otherwise becoming involved in a suit at common law of the same kind. It is amazing, though, that exemplary damages, companies, instead of accepting exemplary damages as a lesson learned, essentially a good butt paddling, companies scream bloody murder. Some spend millions of dollars going on television advertising and crying in crocodile tears. awards. These jury awards are just out of control. Tort reform, bull. The reality is that these ridiculous awards that they talk about are extremely rare, and they almost never get past appeal anyway. The exemplary damages are there to show the company that it was wrong for what it did, beyond just the injury it did to the party. Can't emphasize that enough. If you don't want to have exemplary damages kick you in the ass, then don't make mistakes. Don't hurt your customers. I mean, damn, that's simple logic, but companies, McDonald's, it's coffee, was directly the cause of burning an old woman's legs and her crotch to the point where she had to have plastic surgery. And instead of accepting the jury's award to the injured woman, McDonald's screams bloody murder, cries crocodile tears, makes a big thing about it, never mentioning that the award that was originally given to the woman was reduced substantially. But McDonald's was still out there to make sure everyone knew that it wasn't their fault, their coffee. Now, let me get this clear. Let me make this clear to you. The case at bar was a cup of coffee that was served at a McDonald's drive-thru. The old woman's grandson was driving a car, and she was sitting in the driver's seat. After she received the coffee, she put it in between her legs, I believe to put cream in it or something along that line, and her grandson lurched forward in his car, and the coffee spilled all over her. It left major burns on her thighs and in her privates. She required surgeries to deal with the resulting injuries. The coffee that McDonald's serves is served at a temperature in excess, I believe, of 180 degrees. And they say that their coffee consultant says that people want the coffee that hot. And that's why. Now, personally, I do not want a cup of coffee that's going to turn my tongue into flesh flowing off. Yeah, go ahead.
Standard is
160 degrees. Yes. I know it. No coffee shop in its mind, but McDonald's, our coffee consultants are the best, and they say 180 degrees. It might have even been 185. We're talking about coffee near boiling. McDonald's pointed, they said it wasn't our coffee, it was that irresponsible grandson of hers lurching forward that caused this to happen. Now, this is where I get into the concept of a design defect, as opposed to a manufacturing defect. In this regard, as far as design defects go, there are two different tests that you could talk about. One would be a risk utility test. This is the one that a lot of conservative legal scholars want everyone to, all the courts to go to, looking at whether the risks outweigh the benefits. The other test that is still very much around is what is called the consumer expectation test. Now, let's talk about it from a consumer expectations point of view. Is coffee supposed to give you second and third degree burns? That's the question. Res ipsa loquitur. Get your consultants out of the way. Get all these ideas out of the way about who was responsible for what and where and how fast the car lurched and all that. Let's talk about the basic idea here. Is coffee supposed to hurt you that badly? Is any food? Now, sure, in a risk utility sort of sense, if I go to a restaurant and I order, have you ever been to one of those sushi restaurants where they have that deadly poison fish and only an expert sushi master knows how to cut it out? That stuff is dangerous as hell. I've had it. You know, you've heard of this? My mouth was numb. I was eating it. It was perfectly prepared, but it made my mouth. I thought, damn, if he missed that knife a couple more millimeters, my mouth would be. You tell risk, you tell it. Sure, I'm bearing a risk there. I know I'm eating a deadly poison fish, for God's sake. I buy a trip down into the ocean, swim with the sharks, no cage. Well, gee, Zilly, damn. I know there's going to be danger down there. I am bearing risk knowingly. I'm assuming risk. But I'm not assuming the risk of getting third-degree burns when I go to a damn McDonald's. And you are, by the way, absolutely right. And that was one of the issues that was that is major there. What is the, not so much what are government standards, but what is standard in the industry? Have those standards led to these kinds of accidents? Okay, well, those are the standards. People don't get hurt when those standards are followed. Here are your standards that deviate from the industry standards. And lo and behold, we've got someone who has been really hurt. Long ago, I was driving along. I was smoking and I accidentally tried to flick my cigarette out the window and it came right back in and landed on my lap. Went right down between my legs. Okay, now there I am being stupid, clearly. Then, of course, I take my cup of coffee that I just gotten at the 7-Eleven, and that's the only thing I could do to keep from burning up in my crotch. And so I poured the coffee right there, too. And that really didn't help any matters a whole lot. People driving by me, watching me go like this, I then speeding. Now, there I'm being dumb, and I'm being... But, interestingly enough, that coffee did hurt like hell, but it did not give me third-degree burns, for God's sake. Now, I'm bringing up this. This is the hot one with conservative legal scholars. They've made a recommendation in a distribution, a publication, that does not have the force of law, but it is quite influential on revising tort law. This risk-utility test is their big love child, and businesses are all kinds of excited about risk utility. Nevertheless, consumer expectation is, even though flawed in some ways, it comports much more with how the world really works in terms of what people do, how people act and react. I slipped right there into design defects, and let me break down defects into manufacturing versus design. And I'm, as far as defects go now, it's almost like if I start talking too much about them, it'll confuse what is otherwise a pretty obvious concept. A manufacturing defect is a defect in just a one product cycle or in something that happened that was not part of the plan. A design defect goes deeper. The design of the product itself was flawed. This can get extremely complicated, though, in suits at common law. And this, at least to some extent, in some cases, you have to go back to res ipsa lacuator, the idea that at the end of the day, after you've confused the hell out of the jury and even confused the litigants with all of the different experts and the different designs and the different discussions of this, that, and the other thing, you have to get down to, well, what happened? Someone's responsible here. Someone got hurt. Okay. Design defects sometimes are actually kind of hard to find. And unfortunately, it is the case that sometimes a lot of people have to be hurt before a design defect is discovered. And even once there is data to support the design defect, it is difficult to point to exactly what it is that's causing the injuries. And there have been efforts by defendants to the effect, okay, fine, you've shown that this group of people was hurt. You have correlated it with the use of our product, but you still have not shown what exactly it was in the design that caused this to happen. You haven't shown that yet. In fact, to some extent, tobacco companies relied upon this for years, this argument that you've shown the people who smoke get lung cancer. We can argue the other side of that, that in fact, we can show in other countries people have very high smoking rates where there is no incidence of lung cancer like it is here in the United States. You have also not demonstrated that it's the smoking and not the lifestyle in general. Poor people smoke, poor people tend to get cancers of all kinds at higher rates. And then they got to this, you are not showing what it is exactly that is the causative chain from the ingestion of the nicotine and the tars to the introduction, to the development of the neoplasms. Now that was wiped off the table, as you know, the big tobacco, there was a big settlement, all that kind of stuff. At some point, the courts have gone to this. We don't necessarily have to show exactly the causative agent. What we have to show is that it is reasonable to believe that because all of these people have gotten hurt and they all used your product, then there is enough evidence there to find you liable. I don't like it. It's suspicious, especially when you get down to things like certain. But on the other hand, the alternative is the safe harbor. Understand that right now, Congress is developing a body of legislation protecting pharmaceutical manufacturers from lawsuits. That is the other side, and that's even worse when you give complete immunity to the manufacturers of drugs. You're giving them all kinds of license to be very sloppy. Let me put something up right here on the table. Following government standards is not an affirmative defense. We met all government standards with respect to this product, with respect to its manufacture, with respect to its distribution, with respect to its design, blah, blah, blah. That immunizes us. No, it doesn't. No, it does not. That is why many organizations have gone to private resources. They have moved away from a mechanical defense. Well, we follow the government's rules and that means that we'll be okay. Horse crap. Many organizations have gone to ISO 9000 standards and other standards like that, which are punishing months-long grueling processes to come into compliance with much stricter standards than the government imposes. And the payoff to this is, first of all, that many manufacturers expect their suppliers to be ISO compliant. You also find out that because you are actually doing things the right way for the right reason, instead of doing things the right way just so you can avoid lawsuits, tends to come out with better products. Shock of all shocks. It also tends to do better for your managerial competence level, for your worker satisfaction, even though it's hard, and trust me, going through the ISO standards, getting through that is like hell. And then you have to live in that world forever. But the payoff is that you are no longer building your products looking for ways to avoid lawsuits. You're actually building your products so that they will not be subject to lawsuits. Great idea. But it also means that you actually have to act like a business person. You don't have to care about your customers. Don't get me wrong. But what you do have to care about is your business. And if you're constantly killing people, making people hurt, and then going around spending your money on advertising and paying off politicians to do tort reform, you are wasting your money. The reality of it is that far too many companies think that if they buy off their politicians, if they buy off the media, if they advertise fluff and puff with their products, that's what they should be doing to make their company profitable in the long run. They'll be eaten alive by the companies that really do get their major shit together and deal with the problem from the ground up. Let's make a good product. Let's do it better than the government tells us. And let's kick the ass of our competition by making a product the consumers actually like and doesn't hurt them. Those are your two types of defects, manufacturing defects and design defects. Negligence defenses. First, for any more, the idea of contributory negligence is not going to play well in most courts. Claiming, well, you did kind of stupid with our product, so because you might be 10% responsible, we're off the hook. That's the way it used to be. Still is in some places. Fortunately, most states go with comparative negligence. As long as the defendant is more than 50% liable, then, the plaintiff is awarded. Let me show you. Suppose, with comparative negligence, it's actually kind of simple. Suppose that your actual hospital bills were $100,000 and you are suing because of a manufacturing defect. However, a design defect. However, the jury determines that you were 20% responsible for your injury and the manufacturer was 80% responsible. Now, what will happen is that you would, in that case, have shown that you're to be made economically whole would take $100,000, let's say, your medical bills. Well, you will get, in this case, $80,000 under the contributory negligence standard, as long as you weren't 50%, more than 50% liable. Did I say that wrong? Yes, comparative. Under the comparative negligence standard, you would get $80,000. As long as your contribution to the your suffering was not more than 50%, you'll get something. You'll get your percent of the award, as I showed it right there. Have you ever used a tool for something it wasn't meant for? Ever use a screwdriver to open a lid, or I mean anything? Have you ever used a flathead screwdriver to open a turn of Phillips screw, or done all manner of things people will do? The question there is, and this actually plays to a lot of different ideas, consumer expectation versus risk utility, design defects, manufacturing defects, duties of care, and comparative negligence, contributory negligence. These all play in because in the real world, a lot of times products are not used as intended. Now, you can have warnings, and warnings are definitely a means of defense. A warning must be clear, it has to be feasible to provide the warning, and it has to address matters in such a way that it can be reasonably expected to reduce the incidence of accidents and or the seriousness of those accidents. A warning that's just a warning, don't do this, probably isn't a warning that's going to reduce accidents. But if you get explicit, you know, maybe show a picture of blood flying out of a person's face, that would probably be a little bit more. Caution, this coffee is hot. The problem with that is that's not really a whole lot of good. Yeah, so's my girlfriend. She's hot. You could say that. It's almost like some of these warnings you almost want to trivialize. There's almost a risibility. Well, geez, there are some websites that show you the ones that are these ridiculous warnings. They aren't going to do anything but make people laugh. And also, some warnings, they are not clear. They're not going to do anything for you. And it is amazing what people will try to do with things. And people have been hurt terribly. But then again, there are injuries there's almost no way to warn about. I'll give you a stupid example. Have you noticed that I have a rather odd nose? It's kind of big and bulbous and crooked on... It's part of the crookedness is from being in fights when I was younger, but the bigness of it is because I come from German Jewish ancestry. Big nose, and I'm proud of it. Interestingly enough, in my family, ever since they were before, probably none of you are old enough to remember the old flip-top cans and the bottles that open. Now they've got those ones, and you push the can lid back. Those things scratch my nose. I literally cut my nose on those because my nose is just big enough that when I try to drink it, it cuts it. My daughter is exactly the same way. She cuts her nose on those. Now, is that, first of all, something that can be reasonably avoided with a warning on the label? Certainly, probably not. Okay? So, and is there going to be a really major injury from it? Certainly not. Is there a likelihood of a lot of people being injured this way? Certainly not. So should a warning be on the can? Certainly not. Big nose people, watch out for our cans. They'll cut your nose. All right, let me finish this up with warranties. Now, there are two flavors of warranties. There are express warranties, And then there are also implied warranties. Now, the express warranties are under UCC 2-313. Express warranties under UCC 2-313. And the language of that, the language of which is in the textbook. It's worth it for you to read it. It's a little surprising to you. You do not have to just say, warranty. If you make a promise of fact, represent a fact, and that fact becomes a basis for bargaining for the good, that is an express warranty. Express, not even implied, express. You affirm a fact or guarantee conformity with descriptions that you have given of the product, you mean an express warranty. And it's even more serious than that. You provide a sample. And unless you state otherwise, that sample represents the warrant of the good that will be sold. Sample or model. Unless you say explicitly, our product isn't like this sample, and you get pretty explicit about it, you are, by giving the sample, providing express warranty to the product that will ultimately be sold. So, when you give a promise or describe, make a statement of fact, and give indication that the product itself that is sold will conform with your promise or your statement of fact, there's express warranty. You give a sample or present a model, and you do not make an indication that the actual product will be different from the sample or the model, there is an express warranty. Right there. That is UCC 2-313. So you be careful about what you represent, because what you represent can very quickly become express warranty. If the consumer or the buyer of your good, whatever the buyer is, presumes that this is going to be a basis for negotiation of the bargaining. And that's about, that pretty much that would be the way it would work unless you were very clear. Well, look, I just said this about this product, but I don't want you to try to bargain with me to buy it based on this because what I said was a lie to you. You're not going to do that. So when you start making statements of fact about your product, making promises, making representations about your product, show samples, show models, whew, boy, implied warranty. First of all, under UCC, this is under UCC 2-314. First, usage and trade. If you are a seller, with respect to the goods that are the subject of a particular sale, you are conveying an implied warranty. That's usage and trade, implied warranty. Fitness for particular purpose, implied warranties. Does a seller know a particular purpose for which those goods might be used? And is the buyer basing negotiations on that purpose? You're looking at me a little blank on that one. Let me try it. Let me try it this way. Got any crowbars in your store, ma'am?
No.
Well, this is a hardware store. You got screwdrivers, don't you? You got screwdrivers. I didn't expect maybe you'd have crowbars, but you got screwdrivers, don't you? Yes, sir, we do. And so you sell me a damn big flathead screwdriver. I come back the next day and I've got the upper part of the screwdriver is lodged into my nose. Oh, God darn you! You knew very well what I was going to do with that damn screwdriver. Particular usage. You had a reasonable expectation. Now, I'm not going to say that this one would probably win in a lawsuit, but do you see the idea that it was, I bought that. That was my basis of bargaining on something that she had reason to believe, good reason to believe I was going to do. I had asked for a crowbar, so clearly I wanted something that was going to separate one thing from another, and when she didn't have the crowbar, I bought from her a screwdriver. So she had knowledge before the fact of what I was going to use for. She had reason to believe that my basis of bargaining by buying it from her was for that particular usage. Careful there. Be careful there. Okay. Now, in terms of implied warranties, going back to usage and trade, we've been in business since 1986 selling our stuff. Right there, You are setting up yourself as not just a vendor of a good, but as a vendor in good standing and long reputation. You are using your reputation for having been in this business as a tool for your side in bargaining. You understand that when I put up my sign, I've been in business for 25 years. Whether or not I actually do it, that becomes part of my basis for bargaining with you, for you to use my services or buy my products. And therefore, I want you to have that as a basis for our bargaining. So when I put up those kinds of signs, and there's nothing wrong with doing it, be proud of the fact that you've been in business that long. There's no question about it. But you also understand that by doing that, you are constructing some of the arguments for implied warranties with respect to especially services that you render, goods that you render, that you sell. So be careful about that, because implied warranties, people think that, well, I have to, you know, put it in writing, warranty on this product. No. No, the UCC provides for plenty of room for you to be giving implied warranties, and you might not even know you're giving implied warranties on your product. Now, one last thing, Magnuson Moss. Warranty Act. Congress got really sick some years back of the hodgepodge of warranty. Games even within UCC, arguments that companies were trying to pull out. Well, I didn't do an implied warranty on this product. So Congress tried, and unfortunately, the book goes overboard, just almost trashes Magnuson Moss, saying it had all the wrong consequences. It was a try. It's better than nothing. Now, the way, and boil it down to this, under Magnuson Moss, if you are not providing a full warranty, which would mean you repair the good back to new, or if you cannot within a reasonable time, you replace it with new, that would be a full warranty. You either repair it, are able to repair it back to new, or replace it with new if you can't repair it back to new within a reasonable time. If you are not providing for a full warranty under those conditions, then you must express clearly the limited warranty and what the limits from full warranty are. Now, what this did essentially, and the book is correct in this regard, but like I said, trashing the whole act. I get this impression of trying to. What essentially happened was that every company in the world, it seems like, just immediately went to limited warranty, and then they just started listing. Here are our limits on our warranty. Blah, blah, blah. Making the limited warranty so long that people didn't even look at them. Do you know what the warranties are on your product you buy? Let me ask, honestly, have you ever read your limited warranty sticker on the little sheet that comes with the limited warranty in the booklet or on the piece of paper in an electronics toy you buy?
Once on my laptop.
It's funny, that was exactly the one I did. You know, I want to know exactly how many pixels have to be dead before they'll take it back and all that kind of stuff. But generally speaking, it's just companies just simply just slam in, well, it's a limited warranty, here are all the limits, we're going to make this so long that you will never read it, and then when your product breaks, we'll just tell you, oh, that's not covered by the warranty. So in that regard, it did backfire. Magnuson Moss did. On the other hand, interestingly enough, there really are companies that, strangely enough, they still do limited warranties, but they just do it almost as a knee-jerk. They are as close to full warranties as you could ever dream. Matter of fact, they're beyond full warranties. Great example. Have you seen those ads on TV? I've noticed out here, infomercials are actually the major programming on the TV out here. Those ones. And if your Ginsu knives ever break or get dull, we will replace them free. Have you seen those? I mean, they're jaw-dropping. I've bought those products. It's limited warranty. They have a limited warranty card. Why are you calling this a limited warranty? Well, they're just doing it almost like a gut reaction. These people actually do pretty much do beyond even a full warranty. Full warranties aren't lifetime. It's almost like they're afraid to say full warranty for fear they haven't thought of something. But there really are some products that are really close to full warranty, even though it says limited warranty. One last thing, as far as liability goes, I want to bring up the idea of liability tails. Liability tails, T-A-I-L-S. This was the American private plane manufacturing industry in the United States literally came close to absolute total death because essentially planes built years before were getting old and people were suing when death and major injury occurred in old private planes like Cessnas, Beeches, Pipers, and all that. And it was just pretty much the insurance rates that these airplane manufacturers were paying was just insane. Those kinds of liability tails can just kill an industry. You essentially created a stream of liabilities that come back to haunt you. A major aspect of tort reform has been creating a cutoff date when no more lawsuits could be filed because of a design defect or a manufacturing defect. Because remember that in general, you cannot rely upon a defense as a manufacturer. Well, these were the standards of the time. That's not an absolute defense. So even if, as a plane manufacturer, you build a private plane in 1985, and it meets standards of that time, and someone sues you this year, that person could bring up design specifications, safety features, that came about after that time. That's legitimate in court. So it required legislation simply at the federal level, and states are getting into this too, just simply saying there's a point where no more lawsuits. 10 years, 15 years, that's it. If the plane is older than that, if the product is older than that, then you can't sue because it hurts you. I mean, by that time, the product is getting old. The product is, technology hasn't just changed, it's gone through revolution possibly. So we can't even talk about the defects in design of that time relative to the designs of our day and age. Even our jury probably would not have many members who would know about what was prevailing in that time frame. Now, this does cause some issues. I'll give you a great example. Long time friend of mine, fellow private pilot, back when I was a flyer, a private pilot. He actually bought an airplane that was built in the 60s, early 60s. Now, this airplane actually had like a hammock seat. It was a wooden hammock seat. Kind of the way it was done. It was a very hot airplane for its time, but a hammock seat. Well, he took that plane off and he was doing some aerobatic type of stuff with it. It could handle some aerobatics. And he pitched the plane up and he got up to about 5,000 feet and then he decided he was going to do a really fast climb up to about 7,000. He pitched the plane up, and if you've ever been in a small plane, you're just leaning back, you feel the G's. It was actually a stick, not a wheel. And the hammock broke. He went clear back in the plane to the firewall. Now, can you imagine? You're going up like this. Gravity's pulling your ass back like this. The only thing you're holding on to is a stick, which you're pulling back, which is making you go even faster upward. And there was basically almost nothing he could do. He was going to simply take that plane into what would have essentially been either a loop or into a hammerhead stall. One or the other would have happened. Now, the question is, was that a design defect in the plane or not? At the time the plane was built, would they have had any kind of an expectation that something like that could have happened? If they did, it was an enormous, abominable mistake. If they didn't, well, tort reform has answered the question. We shouldn't let him sue this airplane manufacturer for something that long ago. Well, there's a couple of things in play here. Fortunately, he finally got the presence of mind to do what he, to think about what was going on. And what he did was he finally let go of the stick, which allowed the stick to begin to come forward, and he was managed to be able to grovel his way forward and get the nose back down. Turns out, reading through the literature, well, there were an awful lot of accidents with this plane where pilots mysteriously went into rapid climbs, looped over, and then spun into the ground. I'll be damned. Never any lawsuits about it, but sure enough, this was something that was a design defect from the very beginning. And they had gotten by with this design defect until they had safe harbor with that tort reform. Keep that in mind. Sometimes it's a great idea to clip the tail on liability. Sometimes it's years before someone figures out exactly what a design defect is and figures out that a lot of people were killed by the design defect, and no one ever knew it. No one ever knew it with these pilots because the pilots were all dead except for him. He had actually managed to crawl back up to the front. That's all I have for you. I thank you.